Chapter 6.
Raven Gap, Georgia, United States of America, Sol 3. 1200 hours, EDT Monday, September 28, 2009 AD. Tommy looked up from his ammunition readouts as the Major slid over the side of the Reaper's fighting position. The Reaper position was about 100 meters behind the primary defense line, not far from the battalion headquarters hole. Like the battalion position, the Reapers had just shoveled out an area about 6 meters across. In their case, there were two different levels, with the shallower being at the rear. The Reapers, if they had any ammunition, could engage with a variety of heavy weapons. They had 75-millimeter auto-mortars for indirect fire and heavy flechette cannons for close-in work, both of these besides their anti-lander systems. Unfortunately, in the last 9 hours, they had shot through every bit of ammo they carried in, gone out and scrounged up most of the additional packs, and shot all of them off. They had moved forward to the line twice to support with flechettes, engaged additional landers and fired off mortars until the position was mostly protected by empty ammo boxes. But at this point, they were pretty much flat. Tommy had about 2 dozen magazines left, but they weren't compatible with any of the Reaper systems, and 2 dozen mags weren't going to stop the Posleen. That was not a particularly comfortable thought as he watched not only his own ammo, but the rest of the battalions going down like a waterfall. "Lieutenant," Mike said as he slid into the mud in the bottom of the hole. The light rain had dropped off, but had lasted long enough to saturate everything in sight and fill all the holes with a few inches of slippery orange clay, the infamous Georgia red clay, for which the region was unjustly famous. One of the areas that the battalion's energy was flowing away to was simply keeping the suits from sinking into the bog. "Major," Tommy replied. If O'Neill wanted to go with monosyllables, fine by him. "You've been watching the battalion's readouts?" the commander asked. Yep, the lieutenant replied. "There is one possible way we can continue the mission. Sort of." "And that would be, sir..." "You're sounding rather cynical, Lieutenant," the major said. It was impossible to get anything like body language through the suits, but Tommy would swear O'Neill was amused. "Well, sir, I like killing Posleen. Not having them kill me because I'm out of ammo. That sort of situation always annoys me." "Good news, then. You and your troops are in position to save the day." "Ah, great, sir. Does this involve killing Posleen?" "Possibly. But mostly it involves being pack mules. Your team has been using standard ammo, so you're at the top of the power levels in the battalion, and you're out of ammo. So I'm sending you to go pick some up. And some power." Tommy raised his hands, palms upward. "They also serve who simply fetch ammo. Are they sending in resupply birds?" "No, but coincidentally, there's a rather large cache of ACS materials nearby." "Ah, one that's off the books. So until we started discussing it, the Posleen shouldn't have known about it." Tommy worked his face inside the gel in lieu of shaking his head. "Off the books? Well, I'd have preferred that nobody find out, but if it's a choice of facing a court of inquiry for putting a cache at your family farm, or having my battalion wiped out, I know which way I'll hop." "Oh. More good news. Sort of. Your girlfriend is at the farm with a mixed group of civilians and military personnel. You can enlist her as a pack mule." Tommy's jaw worked inside the armor and he counted to 10. "You want me to bring Wendy up here? What in the hell is she doing anywhere near this shit?"
"The same thing my daughter is. Surviving," O'Neill said with a smile in his voice.
"Your daughter?"
"She apparently survived the nuke that killed my father," Mike answered and gestured to the northwest. "They're about 6 miles that way. That's where I grew up."
"Oh, holy shit, sir, I'm..."
"Don't worry about it," Mike said, waving a hand. "Let's just say that we both have good reason to hold this position, and to survive doing so." He paused for a moment, then gestured helplessly. "But even if we can retake the pass after we pull out, we're probably not going to walk out, or hell, even be carried out."
"They're sending the Shiva, sir."
"Yeah, one Shiva, about 1 million Posleen. I'm sorry, but no offense. I wouldn't even expect the 10,000 to make it, much less one unsupported Shiva. The point is, when you see my daughter, just tell her I love her, okay?"
"Okay, sir," Tommy started to reply, then stopped at a raised hand.
I've given your AID all the information it needs about the cache and the link-up point, O'Neill continued. We're critically short on time, so I want you to pull out right away, even before the rest of the battalion. Despite the time issue, you should take some R&R time when you meet up with the group and your lady friend. O'Neill waved vaguely again, then tapped the knee of the lieutenant's suit. Take what you can while you can get it, Tommy. There's only so much that God gives us in this life. With that, he rolled back out of the hole and crawled towards the battalion position. Boss, there's a little problem here. Sergeant Major Ernie Pappas still preferred the term gunny. He'd retired as a Marine gunnery sergeant long before aliens were anything more than science fiction. But as one of the early rejuves, he had been either training or in the front line since the first landings, and he knew a screwed-up tactical situation when he saw one. Sure is, O'Neill replied. Pulling out is going to be a stone-cold bitch. The battalion was laying down a continuous curtain of fire, but the Pozzolines seemed to be limitless. They had slowed down in their advance, and all the forces to the north had pulled out, but they still were in continuous contact. When the battalion pulled out, it had basically two choices. It could pull out fast, above ground, or dig backwards. But in neither case could it maintain fire. And some of the suits, despite refills, were reaching red zone on power again. We're going to get chewed up when we exit, he continued. Shit happens. We're not just going to get chewed up, the gunny said. We're going to get hammered. What if they pursue us? Stewart asked. I have to take their side here. We'll go up Black Rock Mountain, O'Neill said. They're going to find pursuit tough. You're hearing all of this, you know, Duncan interjected. Yeah, but I don't think their attacks can coordinate this fast, Mike said. Otherwise, they'd be all over us. We've been hit hard, what, 5 or 6 times? If whoever is running the show over there could hit us hard now, he would. Traffic control must be a beast, Stewart pointed out. So we should get while they're limited? Except we're still going to get hammered, Gunny Pappas said. You keep saying that, Gunny. I know. We'll get less hammered if somebody stays back to suppress them. O'Neill turned his body towards the veteran NCO. You've got to be joking. I can run a simulation, sir, the gunny replied formally. We're looking at nearly 50% casualties if we just pop out of the holes and run. We're out of grenades. We're out of mortars. We're out of anything we can use to knock them back. We're getting 5 to 6 God Kings on the line at a time now. Unless they're engaged, they'll hammer us even under holograms. I know, Gunny, but that doesn't mean I'm going to sacrifice some pawns to save the king, O'Neill said quietly. Or a knight. We're all going out as fast as we can. We only have to get around the corner of the ridge. 15, 20 seconds tops in view. With every Pozzoline in sight hammering us from the rear, Duncan pointed out, which is our most lightly armored spot, except on you. Thanks, Mike replied coldly. We've got a few troops that are mobility-challenged anyway, Pappas said grimly. Nagel and Talbridge both lost a leg. Others have been hit. Leave me behind with a group of the worst off. Lowest on power, shot up, the sick, lame, and lazy. We'll provide cover fire. We can fall back by fire and maneuver, Stewart said. Except I'm not an idiot, and I know the Pozzoline just walk right into it. Christ! Top! Mike looked at the ground as the other suits turned to look at him. Finally he spoke. 15. That's enough to suppress their fire as we retreat. I'll dump a list. He paused and switched over to a private frequency. Top, I forgave you for First Washington a long time ago. I know you did, boss, the sergeant major replied gruffly. You want to stay, but you know you can't. The battalion will just go away if you buy it. You need Duncan and Stewart to watch out for the details. I can hold for long enough. Masovich led the way up the slope and over the hill. At this point, between the continuing rain and the heavy traffic into and out of the cache, there was a noticeable and slippery trail into the cave. The wet and the slope were not the only obstacles with which they had to contend. The hills were littered with fallen trees. The area had suffered repeated, multi-kiloton strikes, and while none of them had been on the near side of the hill, the ground shock and pressure wave had still dropped trees and caused small landslides. They moved carefully, crawling over individual fallen trees, detouring around tangles from slides, the wet leaves slipping and slithering under their feet, until they reached a point just below the crest of the ridge. Then Masovich halted the group, and Leopard crawled up to the ridgeline. He had seen the valleys below only a few weeks before, and the devastation that greeted his eyes required a moment's adjustment. The western end of the main valley of the Gap was just visible from his position. The Gap was a narrow but low north-south crack in the wall of the Tennessee Divide, a crack from which the continuous racket of battle resounded. Masovich wasn't sure what the situation was at the moment, but there was no question the ACS were hotly engaged. Just to the north of the Gap, the valley widened out to the east and west. This valley was both low and fertile and had once provided a significant fraction of the produce necessary to run the defending corps. When Jake and Mueller had passed through, only a week before, it had been busy with the movement of the corps and the tan and yellow with the corn. Barley and pumpkins were ready to harvest. Now it was a barren wasteland. The only sign that there had ever been defenders was a pile of melted metal that Jake suspected used to be an artillery battery. The ground itself was black and gray, with some patches that looked shiny as if they had been turned to glass. The tree-clad slopes that had surrounded it were now covered in fallen, leaf-stripped trunks that looked like nothing so much as scattered matchsticks. The O'Neill farmstead was in a small pocket or hollow on the north side of the main valley, and about 200 feet higher. It was roughly diamond-shaped, with the entrance pointing slightly southwest rather than directly south. The entrance ran up the gully created by O'Neill Creek and made several twists. Given that the hollow was settled in the early 1800s, it appeared that the O'Neill paranoia was probably hereditary. The holler had not suffered as severely as the main valley, but it was badly damaged. The far side of the holler was totally destroyed, with all the trees down in a center zone that was scoured down to the bare rock. The lander must not have been very high. The house was splinters, and the heavy sandbag and concrete bunker to the side, which had been hidden in a hedge, was smashed to ruin. It was in the latter ruin that Callie said O'Neill had last been seen. The near side slope was not as badly hit, but it was still going to take quite a while to pick their way down the hillside. There had been a path, but it was nearly invisible for the fallen timber. The one good piece of news was that the most probable avenue of approach, up the road which had apparently been ground zero, was completely covered in trees and rock slides. Mueller led the way down, occasionally moving the more accessible trees and rocks. Despite his care, he slipped twice on the wet hillside, once very nearly breaking a leg. "At least the Pauzlim were going to have trouble getting in," Masovich said when he caught the far larger NCO on the second fall. "Which just means we get to dig out his body," Mueller said quietly. "Even if he was alive, and it didn't sound like he was, he's not going to have survived the night." "We'll see," Masovich said. He slid over the bole of an oak that must have been growing there since during the Civil War, and then down the relatively open bluff beyond. Over the last few years, he had humped up and down these mountains to the point that he considered most obstacles to be pretty easy stuff. But this tangle of fallen trees was a pain in the butt. The last slither, though, dropped him into a narrow strip of ground behind one wing of the O'Neill house, which was relatively free of debris. There was a fair amount of the house itself, including scattered clothing that they really ought to collect up for the refugees. But his attention was centered on the bunker. Most of the house was backed into the hillside, and the bunker was on the far side. "Sergeant Major Masovich," his AID chimed, "be aware that there is a slight increase in radiation in this zone." "Bad?" "Not really. It won't reach clinically challenging levels for another 6 to 8 hours, and the isotopes that I'm detecting are of a type to decay quickly. The radiation will reduce faster than you're absorbing it." "Okay, but we still don't want to stick around," he said, waving the group around the house. He moved cautiously. Despite the fact that the area looked clear, it was possible that the odd Pauzlim might be moving around or even waiting in ambush. Most Pauzlim normals were bonded to individual god kings. However, when their master was killed, the normals tended to become unbonded. Thereafter, until picked up by another god king, they wandered more or less as wild animals. These ferals were an increasing problem, not only along the frontier, but in areas of the interior. Pauzlim reproduced at a phenomenal rate and tended to survive infancy even without care, so a single feral could pump out multiple young in just a few years, each of which reached maturity in 18 months. Thus, in areas where they were not kept in check, they occupied a primary carnivore niche in the food chain. Jake Mosevich was not about to enter that food chain if he could avoid it. The area appeared clear, however, and he slipped around the stump of the house to the front, carefully sweeping his rifle from side to side as the rest of the group closed up behind him. He could see the bunker clearly now, and he could see a very man-shaped hole where something wasn't. "Callie!" he called, walking over to the bunker as he lowered the barrel on his rifle. The bunker had reinforced concrete walls with a sandbag and steel top. It was clearly designed to survive heavy-duty direct fire. The nuke, however, had ripped most of the sandbags off the top and smashed in one side of the concrete wall, dropping shattered concrete and bent steel I-beams into the interior. Despite that, Papa O'Neill might have survived. Overpressure blasts from nukes did more destruction to items than had an inside and outside than the rather homogeneous character of the human body. Jake remembered about 1,000 years ago taking a class on nuclear warfare that covered that fact. Houses tended to be ripped to shreds in conditions where humans survived just fine. The heat and the radiation might kill them, but not the overpressure unless they were at ground zero or picked up and tossed by it. Only two problems. Papa O'Neill had been inside the bunker when it collapsed. The debris was likely to have killed him. Second problem being that he wasn't there. It was pretty evident that something or someone had come along and dug a body out of the rubble. "He was right there," Callie said quietly. "Yep," Jake squatted and looked into the interior of the bunker. The rear was down as well, but a doorway was faintly visible at the rear. "Is that how you got out?" "Yeah," Callie said, bending down to peer into the rubble. "He was right there, Sergeant Major." "He's gone now, Callie," Jake said gently, straightening up. "Let's take a quick look around to see if there's anything worth salvaging, then get back to the cache before whatever took him comes back." "Puzzling?" Mueller asked, looking at the ground. "Most of the grass had been flesh-burned by the blast, but there should have been tracks. Puzzling made very definitive tracks with their claws." "Probably," Mosevich said after a moment's pause. "I don't see any tracks at all. But the most probable explanation is the Potsies got the body." "Fuck," Callie said. Fuck, goddamn cocksucker. He really didn't want to get eaten. He really, really didn't." "I'm sorry," Wendy said, wrapping her arm around the teenager. "I'm so sorry." "Shit," Callie replied, wiping rain-mixed tears out of her eyes. "Cher is not going to be happy." Wendy snorted and hugged her to her. "No, she's not. None of us are." Elgers was sweeping back and forth around the fallen bunker. But after a moment, she came back, shaking her head. "I find track of Callie no other." Her voice sounded odd, low-pitched and sing-song. Mosevich looked at her sidelong, but Wendy just shrugged. "Annie, you're channeling again." Ever since they had met, the 600 captain occasionally would seem to manifest personalities of other people. In the very few cases where the personalities were obvious and known, they were dead people. It especially seemed to occur when she used a new skill, such as tracking. The captain looked up at the sky and sniffed. "Yes." She sniffed again, deeply, looking toward the road. "Take cover. Someone come." As Mosevich faded backward into the shadow of the ruined house, his AID chirped again. "Sergeant Major, incoming message from Lieutenant Thomas Sunday, Fleet Strike ACS."
"Well, we have the pass," Tulo Stenalor muttered.
He had moved forward from the protected bunkers and factories around Clarksville and now watched the streams of Ultandar moving up to the pass.
"It only took 200,000 Ultos and uncountable Kesentai, and we only have it because they gave it to us. And the ground is torn to ribbons, which will require repair before we can push through effectively. But we have the pass."
"But they will be back," Goliswin said. "They intend to fill it with fire again." The Kesentai was that oddest of individuals among the Pazlin, a known warrior who had quit the strife, settled down, and been bitten by the bug of a hobby. In Goliswin's case, the bug was tinkering. There was nothing he loved more than getting a piece of equipment, human indawi, pozzoline, or aldenada, and taken it apart to figure out how it worked. Tulo Stenelor had tracked him down on a planet a dozen systems away and lured him to Earth with the promise of puzzles to drive him mad. As it had turned out, every puzzle that had been thrown at him, from dissecting human sensor systems to breaking into the ultra-secure AID net, had been apparent nestling play. However, he was still having a fine time. All this and the promise of riches beyond measure in addition. What could be better?
"Yes, but they will have trouble doing that," Tulo Stenelor said.
"Will you pursue?" the technician asked carefully. He was well aware that his understanding of the new methods of the Estinar were spotty. Most Pozzoline Ultendar would latch on and chase the humans to their deaths. Like the Tinkerer, Tulo Stenelor had found a new way to do business. But in the case of Tulo Stenelor, that business was gathering the finest minds he could and then hammering the humans into so much thresh.
"No," Tulo Stenelor said after a moment. "The route they took is difficult enough for them. Trying to pursue them with Ultos would be nearly impossible. We just have to let them go, but I will see what I can do about this resupply mission. What news on their efforts to arrange for fire support?" It was a human term that he had readily adopted.
"Their General Horner is no longer using his AIDs, and the AID network is beginning to attempt to counter my infiltration. But at last word, the only hope was still the Shiva gun they call Bun Bun. It is under repair and is being upgraded near Silva."
"Then something must be done about the infernal contraption," the war leader sighed.
He touched a control on his tenar and waited until it picked the signature of Oristan out of the mass of other Kesentai.
"Oristan?"
The senior Ultendar looked down at the town of Franklin and the gathering lake to the west with distaste. He recalled the first major check to their advance when over 100,000 of the host had been trapped in the collapse of the suburb. Now they were being pushed back to it, and it looked no better than on the way through. Very little in the way of loot, hardly any decent land that had not been torn to shreds. Basically nothing but a useless dot on one of the humans' maps. Such a useless place to fight and die over.
"Estinar?" he replied.
He had hitched his star to Tulo Stenelor all the way back at the Great Gathering. Most of his fellow Ultondar thought him mad. Tulo Stenelor had been badly defeated on Aridon V, and his new way was heretical in the extreme. But Oristan had been picking out all the information he could about these humans, and it was apparent that the usual method of the host of the path to charge ahead trying to use mass to overcome the enemy was a quick route to suicide. Tulo Stenelor's attempt to use human tactics against them had been at least partially successful. Would have been successful had the damn suits not taken the pass and the demon shit Shiva gun had not fought so hard in the retreat. All the highly trained pilots of Tenoral and Ultpos had been destroyed by the gun or machine, and most of the elite Ultendar had been lost in the assault, leaving them with nothing but to fall back on charge and die. Not for the first time, but the first time so clearly, he felt a wave of depression. Such a waste, such an incredible waste. Fine Kesentai, young Pozzoline that he had trained with his own talons, nothing but thresh to be gathered and distributed to the host. There had to be a better way than this.
"The suits are preparing to pull out of the gap," the war leader said. "Unfortunately, they have a distressingly good plan for doing so. They intend to leave a sacrificial rear guard."
"That's unusual for the suits," Oristan said. He had not fought the armored combat suits of the humans, but he had studied all that he could of them, and they rarely sacrificed even one suit, much less a detachment.
"Agreed, but they intend to return. They are awaiting the Shiva gun getting to the vicinity of Franklin, where it will be in range to reach the gap. If it gets there, all will be over. You might as well throw the staff."
"I understand," he replied. He did understand. But understanding and knowing what to do about it were two different things. "I'm getting reports from the front. The Shiva has been significantly enhanced. We couldn't stop it on the way in. I'm not sure we'll be able to stop it on the way back."
"I have somewhat more data," Tulo Stenelor said. "It has been armored and heavy weapons added to it, but it is only armored on the front."
"Ah," Oristan snorted, "not on the sides."
"Only for plasma fire on the sides, and only under certain conditions, if you ambush it."
The war leader used the human term. The Pazlin had no equivalent. "I will do what I can, Estinar," the Ultendar replied. "I will do what I can." He looked to the northeast and was just in time to watch the first fireball. The image was seared on his retina for a moment, the flash of white directly above the main concentration of forces that were lining up to take the road through Rocky Knob Gap. He closed his eyes against the glare as his pupils and internal filters automatically darkened against the damaging light. "Well," he muttered, pulling his crest down against his neck in anger, "now we know which way they are coming."